a pro-life debacle in Kansas. Sinema is a yes, and DeSantis moves against a woke prosecutor. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by Phil Klein, longtime listener, first-time caller, Jack Butler, and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are NetChoice, Masterworks, and the Acton Unwind podcast. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So before we get into it in earnest, let me read everyone a message from our first sponsor, NetChoice. New polling shows 65% of Americans blame Biden and the Democrats for rising inflation. If they stand on a united platform to fight inflation, Republicans will likely do very well in this year's midterm elections. But some lawmakers, like Representative Ken Buck, are degrading that strategy by backing proposals which 85% of Americans believe will make inflation worse. The last thing Republicans should be doing ahead of the midterms is supporting progressive pet projects. Only 1% of voters say they want Congress to focus on tech regulation, while 60% say they want lawmakers to focus on inflation. To win in November, Republicans should listen to the people and fight back against inflationary regulations pushed by progressives. Join us in urging lawmakers to oppose Democratic pet projects like S-2992 and tell Congress to focus on the issues that matter to you. Learn more about this fight and send a letter to your representatives at netchoice.org/2992. That's netchoice.org/2992. This message brought to you, of course, by NetChoice. So MBD had elections on Tuesday, had a really dispiriting outcome in Kansas. We touched on this briefly Tuesday. There was a referendum saying that there is not a constitutional right to abortion, the way the Kansas Supreme Court had just written into the Constitution on its own, and making it clear that the legislature has the power to regulate abortion. And this thing went down by a stunning, basically 60 to 40 margin, a tsunami of Democratic turnout is heartening progressives who now are buoyed in their belief, faith that Dobbs might turn around the midterms. What do you make of it?
It's hard to know what to make of it in some cases. I mean, Kansas was in a very unusual position, as you alluded to, because their own state Supreme Court had done their own state level Roe v. Wade decision, you know, and made abortion a constitutional right. And the way the referendum question was worded was sort of ambiguous, and Republicans didn't do a great job of explaining it. I think most people would have read the question and concluded that they're being asked whether abortion should be completely criminalized in all circumstances. So they had the same confusion many Americans seem to have about Roe, which was that if Roe is overturned, all abortion becomes illegal. So that seemed to be replicated on a state level. And what you saw was basically those rough numbers, which is that, you know, maybe it's just a third of people support something if they think it's a full ban. I don't think voters fully understood the question was, you know, should the legislature be able to legislate on the question? And I think if Republicans in Kansas want to come back to the issue, they have to wait a few years, as Ramesh Puneeru mentioned in a good post about this, and put a very specific question to them, like, would you, you know, support replacing the, you know, in the Kansas Constitution, a text that says, like, we shall ban abortion after 15 weeks, with exceptions for the health and life of the mother, something that polls much, much more favorably. But it's a real defeat, and the turnout numbers are very likely going to scare some Republicans from talking candidly about the issue as they head into November. And I actually think that is the problem. The very problem Republicans face now is that we have to talk about this. We have to explain what we're for. And it also means we probably have to parlay with actual public opinion what people are willing to put up with until we can convince them to come further our way. And so I would encourage Republicans to get practiced at saying both what they believe and what they would propose, even if what they propose is short of what they believe. This is, that's, I
Innocent as a
think,
dove, innocent as a dove, wise as a serpent,
correct.
is the necessary approach. So, Jack Butler, first of all, welcome. You have finally been called off of the bench where you were sitting all these years and months just waiting for your pieces to be selected as editor's picks. But now you are on the playing field, and we're delighted to have you.
It's a real honor, Rich. Thank you for bringing me on.
Of course. So, should Republicans be scared?
I think scared is the wrong word. I think maybe humbled is a better word because, look, this has been there's been a kind of giddiness among some parts of the right in the wake of the Dobbs decision. Like this great stain on our constitutional order has been reversed, and among some of the parts of the conservative coalition who have been inclined in previous years to be more pessimistic about things, it was kind of a it was a real stumbling block for them. And now there's an occasion for apparent pessimism here, but I think that it only goes so far. As Michael mentioned, there are some contingent factors with the referendum, kind of confusing wording, confusing intent. As Dan McLaughlin wrote about in a piece for the website, there's sort of history of Kansas's political situation that is at play here. But there's just a lesson to be learned in the sense of the necessity for presenting pro-life arguments well, and for the continuing necessity, if not the elevated necessity, of being good at politics. I mean, it seems like a basic thing, but this is essentially what Roe has done. The fight, with certain exceptions, is now at the level of states, and this is where the ability to apply political finesse is going to come into play. And if I don't think that they should be scared, but I think there will be some people who will be sort of frightened, and there will be some voices, perhaps among the consultant class or what have you, who are going to use this as yet another occasion to run away from the issue, which should not be done. But neither should it be done that the just sort of garment rending over like America's over that's not the approach here either. It's the Lincoln approach that you have to meet people where they are, understand the circumstances of your state, persuade people, and achieve meaningful victories. And I know that this will mean that in some cases, more babies will be slaughtered than should be, and that's every one of those is a tragedy. But there is no this is no excuse to give up, and it's no excuse to sort of let the left glory in a in its first sort of real victory on this front in political terms, really since Dobbs came down.
So, Jack, by the way, I didn't really properly introduce you because you are a legend here at NR already, but you're the submissions editor. So if people want to send something to the website for consideration, they should send it to you. And if it gets rejected, they should focus all their ire, of course, on you, Jack Butler. So, Phil, I agree with everything that MBD and Jack have said. I think pro-lifers screwed this up royally. In Kansas, the ballot measure was confused and vague, you know, classic instance where it didn't do much. At the same time, it could be portrayed as doing an enormous amount. But there is part of me that worries that pro-lifers might here in this interim period be in the sort of situation that progressives often are. If we just explain it better, if we just explain it better, this issue that we got walloped on, we'll be able to turn around. Do you feel any of that worry too, or you just think it's legitimate? This was a communications and political problem, and we'll be able to adjust effectively going forward.
Look, the reality is that having Roe on the books was atrocious for all the reasons we've been writing about for decades. And it was great. It was an amazing victory to be able to overturn it. And to finally be able to flesh these things out at the state level and actually be able to talk about implementing laws. However, the flip side of having a Roe in place was that it was more easy to have a coalesce around a unified approach among the pro-life movement, because Roe was in place, everyone could agree that Roe should be overturned. And the laws that could be passed within the framework of Roe were limited enough that there was sort of, you could only do incremental things anyway. So there was less room for a lot of debate. But now that Roe's off the books, we're starting with a clean slate where in theory you could make any sort of abortion law that you could get passed at the state level. And so I think that what we're seeing now is the difficulty of trying to get to some sort of consensus, because there are those who I would consider myself of that camp that says that the goal should just be to protect the most lives possible. And that might mean in some states supporting restrictions that don't go as far as we'd like, and maybe being able to push further in some states that are more like us. I think that there's also an idea of persuasion. And in this case in Kansas, I think they sort of put the cart before the horse. And even though essentially the referendum would have gotten rid of the Kansas Roe, mini Roe, and then created an opening for debate because there wasn't any clear consensus on what they were going to do, it made it very easily to say, this is going to be an outright abortion ban. And so I think that in most cases, I mean, if you look at polls on something like, if we're just debating a 15-week abortion ban, I think a majority of Americans and in most states, you could find a majority, or in many states, you could find a majority support for something like that. When you start moving into heartbeat laws and more, more restrictions earlier and earlier, you're going to have to push those in only some states and continue making the argument. But I certainly respect people that say we should go for everything. It's sort of a tragedy if any lives are allowed to be killed. So I certainly sympathize with that. But we're in a new and political environment, and I think that argues for an incremental approach as opposed to trying to go for everything in places where you haven't laid the groundwork.
Yeah. So MBD, a couple other results from Tuesday night. One, great news from Missouri. Eric Greitens gets wiped out, as it turns out, disgraced. That's the adjective always applied, appropriately so. Disgraced former governor of Missouri that led most of the way in that race. Got eclipsed by Eric Schmidt at the end and really fell off. There's a concerted effort to take Greitens down. It was successful. Trump didn't endorse him except for ambiguously. He endorsed Eric, and sure enough, Eric won. But Eric Schmidt, not Eric Greitens. But then not such great news out of Arizona. And Arizona has always been prone to this rough-hewn populism on the right. Jan Brewer, the former governor, Sheriff Joe. And that tendency now has been totally taken over by the Stop the Steal types and made into this really toxic and really powerful, potent political mix. Carrie Lake wins the gubernatorial election, former newscaster, full-on MAGA, Stop the Steal conspiracy theorist. She was trailing most of the night because most of the night the early vote was coming in, and Robeson, the rational opponent of hers, was winning handily in the early vote. And since you know, Lake was telling no one to vote early because he can't trust that whole process, just smashed her in the same day vote. Still a narrow outcome, but she's won. Blake Masters, who also has, you know, played footsie with the Stop the Steal stuff, not as bad as Lake, wins handily the Senate primary. He's endorsed by Trump. So was Lake. And then the Secretary of State guy who's wacky as well. So you look at Arizona and it's not a very encouraging tableau.
You know, it's Arizona is a strange state. You know, John McCain used to win his elections by 10, 15 points. And a lot of conservatives loathe John McCain. I mean, I disagreed with him on probably his signature issues, probably all three of them, immigration, amnesty, foreign policy, adventurism, and campaign finance reform. But Arizona voters liked him a lot. And now you're seeing his actual successor is Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat, who is mavericky and tacking toward the center of her party and willing to buck her party even on some big votes, maybe not as many as we hoped for. And she is reaping political benefit. Meanwhile, the Republicans, who for years were driven nuts by McCain, have taken over the party, like almost on a revenge tour. You know, really started with figures like Kelly Ward, who then took over the state party.
Yeah, it's really interesting, MBD, because you would think of state parties as these reservoirs of the strong points of the establishment. Instead, all around the country, they have been taken over by
the
mega hardcore.
Listen,
become a vehicle of this counter establishment.
I mean, in democracy, as in demography, like who shows up counts, like, you know, can make a difference. So they have made a difference, but I'm not sure it's a good one. Carrie Lake is, you know, a former Obama voter. You know, she's one of these political types who's active on the edges and kind of makes their, doesn't really have a fully formed philosophy, just kind of a populist distrust of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really made Stop the Steal like the focus of her campaign. And, you know, you mentioned Blake Masters, who's the kind of the Peter Thiel supported candidate, who is, you know, Trumpier, maybe even more Trumpy than Trump on foreign policy, trade, and other matters. But he's kind of played light with the Stop the Steal stuff. You know, he'll kind of shrug in his ads and say, I don't know, I think in a fair fight, Trump wins. You know, so somehow the election was unfair, but then he changes the subject to gun regulations or immigration at the border, something like that. Mm-hmm. He's now running dead even or a little behind in the polls for the general election. And I think he's in danger of losing that seat, in part because Carrie Lake is going to make Stop the Steal such a focus, and it's going to motivate Democratic voters to turn out in especially high numbers in that state. And it's going to depress some Republicans. So it's definitely a state to watch. But I've also heard just anecdotally from people who are in Arizona that the level of anger of Republicans at the Republican establishment and at the Biden administration is just off the charts. Mm-hmm. And it's a very suburban state now, in a way it didn't used to be. So, I think it's the most interesting state heading into November.
Yeah. So, Jack, it's interesting. MBD got into some of the parts of Lake's political background that would have been major vulnerability, like in the Tea Party era, right? Those things we would have assumed just would have sunk her. But now, as long as you believe the election was stolen, and, you know, love Dinesh's movie and all the rest of it, that's a Trump card that makes all that go away, with at least a plurality of the Republican electorate, which in a multi-candidate field is all you need to win these primaries.
Right. And we keep seeing that over and over again. You have strongly kind of nuts people who get pluralities, divided field, people with the potential power to push one candidate over the finish line, often not using it or it not being effective. And this is just a sort of replicating pattern. I just have to say, pour one out for Doug Ducey here. He backed the most plausible contender to Lake. He's governed the state of Arizona extremely well. Yep. during his two terms, and it seems to me, observing this from the outside, that he is trying his best to sort of hold the increasingly chaotic environment of the state Republican Party in Arizona together. And it seems that the effort is not working. Now whoever wins in November, his legacy and his accomplishments are at risk in one way or another. And that's just kind of sad, because he's done a great job. And it seems that residents of the state at least like the way he's governed, but it's just sort of a depressing political outcome that has come to this. And I would like to contrast it with what's happened in Georgia. I mean, these are similar states, both narrowly for Trump in 2016, narrowly for Biden in 2020. And as a result of this kind of shift, there was a bit of a psychic break in the state Republican Party apparatus and voters. But it seems in Georgia, with some exceptions, that Kemp, Raffensperger et al. More or less have overcome that. It's looking like Kemp is going to but convincingly defeat incumbent governor Stacey Abrams.
Not easy to beat an incumbent.
Right, I know. It's just
an entrenched
impressive
incumbent like that.
Yeah, it's quite impressive. I mean, Herschel Walker is still a risk, and you still have Marjorie Greene running around in the state. But it's been the sort of psychic break that 2020 affected in Georgia has been kind of overcome, whereas in Arizona, it's sort of lingering still. And you can still, by tapping into that, win over a Republican primary in the way
that you can.
And
also, you know, it might have been different if Ducey, I assume it would have been different if Ducey himself was on the ballot, the way Kemp was, and
right.
Georgia been able to, you know, muster all those advantages of an incumbency. But it's just, you know, rationally, you would think, given what Doug Ducey's done for the state, how well he's governed, I mean, it's just a model of conservative governance. The imperative would be, how do we replicate that? You know, how do we find another person like that? And of course, they've taken the opposite approach. So exit question to you, Phil Klein. Trump was bragging about his endorsement records from Tuesday, or an endorsement record, and justifiably so. You know, he took the pass in Missouri, and I don't think, you know, he wouldn't have made the difference for Greitens. Obviously, that's who he would have liked to endorse, but he held his fire. But he can brag about Arizona and some other outcomes. So let's rate Trump's influence and grip on the party from 10 to 0. 10 is the strongest grip he's ever had, like 2020 strong, near universal support among Republicans for Donald Trump. 0 is like 2012 level support. He's kind of a joke act at CPAC. Where is Trump now?
I would put it about an 8. I wrote a column this week making the point that I think that we can't underestimate the enduring power that Trump has within the party. He hasn't won every race he's jumped into, but he's won a lot of them, a lot of candidates that wouldn't have stood a chance without Trump. And the bottom line is, a lot of elected Republicans will privately say that Trump's putting their Senate, the possibility of getting a Senate majority at risk, but they'll never say that in public. And that too is a testament to Trump's enduring power.
NBD.
It's lower than that. I would say like 6.5. There was a great piece in the Washington Post. I cannot remember.
Not Dylan Byer or something like that. I always mess up his name.
But it was making the point that Trump's influence is declining in the Republican Party because the Republican Party has become more like him, mm-hmm. which is
right.
That in effect, like, if you are the type of person who voted for Trump because you were dissatisfied with Republicans, one, Trump is less at odds with the average Republican than he was 5-6 years ago. And two, Republicans themselves have moved significantly in his direction. So you have less reason to need Trump because you have, you know, Trumpy options. So I think, I think it's declining. Like, I think there's, in a sense, there's a personal defeat for Trump in his long-term political victory.
Subtle. How do you follow that up, Jack? As a newcomer on this podcast, answering your first exit question, can you be more subtle and keen and acute than that?
Well, I just first have to say, I was told there would be no math, so I'm flying blind here. So I'm just going to stick myself right in between the two of them and put it at a 7. I think obviously, So Trump has not receded entirely from the political scene. He's spending political capital like he might at one of his bankrupt casinos. But even at that, I still feel like the sort of nuclear bomb of return to relevance for him of announcing a presidential run has not been launched. And I think that the launching of that thing is just going to cause a lot of people and institutions to reorient themselves around him again. I mean, it's sort of a lot of these entities are waiting in the wings for precisely this occasion. And when it happens, it's going to be kind of a test to see like if anything has changed or not, as he's been sort of plotting in Mar-a-Lago during these intervening months. But I put it at a 7.
You know, it's unbelievable, Jack. Your first exit question, and you nailed the answer entirely. The correct number is 7.
Wow.
It's a huge amount of influence still, but there's downward pressure on it, and he's off of his high point, but still hugely influential. And, you know, one thing that's going to be different this time around, I wrote a column about this today, is he has this establishment now he's built. You know, he owns the RNC. He has all these candidates he's endorsed all over the landscape for offices up and down the ballot. Not all of them will win, but a lot of them will. And even if they're not sincere Trumpists, you know, they'll feel some sense of loyalty, or at least not want to cross them. Enormously well-funded, you know, the super PAC stuff to the gills with over $100 million. You know, he's not spending on anyone else in any appreciable extent. And then this is a real big difference. Now he has a government in waiting, which he didn't have the first time around, in these various America First entities. So that makes him effectively the establishment front runner for the nomination. Now, establishment front runners don't always win. Ron DeSantis is looking very strong in his own right. We'll hit on DeSantis later in the podcast. But Jack, you're so right. The answer is 7. With that, let's hear from our second sponsor this episode, Masterworks. I don't know who's doing a worse job with inflation, Biden or the Fed. So if we're losing 9% of our money just by keeping it in the bank, and the only person making money in the stock market is Nancy Pelosi, then where the heck can you park your greenbacks? How about in one of the only things that's grown 25% this year? Fine art. That's right. Auction sales are up 25% for the first half of 2022, and why shouldn't they be? This is a market fueled by the wealthy elite who invest in art because they know it appreciated at a whopping 33% last time inflation was this high, from 1973 to 1981. But here's where it gets good. These wealthy elite aren't the only ones using art to help hedge against inflation. You can do it too because of Masterworks. They're enabling investors to diversify their portfolios by investing in multi-million dollar paintings from legends like Picasso and Banksy. They analyze millions of data points to identify which paintings demonstrate positive momentum. Then Masterworks acquires these paintings and makes them investable. Basically, you're getting a slice of pizza instead of the whole pie. This means investing in art is no longer reserved for those with tens of millions of dollars. So by joining, you can help hedge against inflation with contemporary art without breaking the bank. With inflation at 9.1%, demand for alternative investments like art is high, and there's a waiting list to join Masterworks and get involved with this platform. But our listeners get priority access. To skip that wait list, just go to masterworks.com and use the promo code editors. Again, that's masterworks.com, promo code editors for priority access. Masterworks.com, promo code editors. Masterworks.com, promo code editors. And see important Regulation A disclosures at masterworks.com/CD. One more time, masterworks.com, promo code editors. So Phil Klein, unsurprisingly, Kristen Sinema is on board the Democratic spending deal. We were talking about this on Tuesday. I think pretty much all of us, except for one, I'm not going to name the panelist who got this one wrong, but we all said the Sinema would end up getting on board. It's just, it was too hard to see her actually resisting the pressure with Democrats so close to getting a number of their priorities. She's knocking out the carried interest tax and getting more climate spending, and she's on board, and Schumer is going to start passing this thing forthwith. What do you make of it?
I mean, I think that the legislation itself is atrocious, and it really undermines a lot of what Manchin was purporting to say last year, because he claimed that one of his big arguments against the Build Back Better plan is that what they were trying to do is fund a bunch of different programs for a couple of years and offset those costs by bringing in 10 years of promised spending cuts or tax increases. And so basically, they've done the same thing here. They're going to expand Obamacare for 2 years. And the savings that they're going to generate are going to occur in the long term. I did an analysis. I had a post up on the corner earlier this week that about 93% of the promised deficit reduction comes after 2026.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, it's a typical Washington game. They front load the spending and then back load the supposed savings. Most of the supposed savings that are coming are by increasing the enforcement budget of the IRS and targeting more taxpayers from more fishing expeditions. In addition to harassing more taxpayers, it's questionable how much the increased enforcement is actually going to bring. There are various theories that the estimates that the IRS puts out on people who the cost of tax noncompliance. But of course, a government agency is always going to say, if you give us more money, it'll actually yield dividends. So it's hard to really know. There's a lot of guesswork involved in the CBO trying to project this. But regardless, even if you view this, on top of this, they're going to have the government fix drug prices now. And the issue with that is that for a long time, the CBO didn't find that saved much money because mm-hmm. it was seen as the government essentially didn't have a lot of leverage in a negotiation of prescription drugs because they didn't have the power for political reasons to just walk away and say, fine, we're not buying that drug. And then no one on Medicare could get a given drug. So the way that they address that issue is that they essentially force private drug makers into these negotiations and threaten them with various punitive taxes. So effectively what they're creating is not a negotiation regime, but a regime in which HHS essentially sets drug prices. That has not worked out well and won't work out well with regard to innovation. And it should be noted that for all the public debate over prescription drug prices, that prescription drugs only make up about 8 or 9% of our overall healthcare spending. So I think this is a really overall a terrible piece of legislation. But if we look at the broader picture, a year ago, when we were staring down the possibility that they could pass a $3.5 trillion bill that created all of these new government programs, certainly it's less bad than that. But the idea that this is going to do even the most charitable reading of it The idea that this is going to do anything about inflation when, Manchin is going around saying, oh, look, there's all this deficit reduction that's going to reduce inflation. Well, the deficit reduction is modest to begin with. And secondly, it's backloaded. So, yeah, if we wait around until 2026 and think that this is going to make a difference, then we could argue about it. But clearly, the idea that it's going to do anything about inflation right now is absurd.
Yeah, so Jack, Phil's right to warn about the prescription drug provisions in here. We really don't want to kill the goose. But just in terms of inflation, all that stuff is backloaded as well when it'll actually supposedly start having an effect, and it'll be a relatively limited range of drugs. So it's just another way, it's completely absurd that this is in any way an inflation reduction act. I think the only hope they can have, and this isn't crazy, is they pass the thing and inflation starts going down anyway based on another factor, and then they can claim, oh, look, we had this bill titled Inflation Reduction Act 2022, and lo and behold, inflation's reduced.
Yeah, when is Congress going to pass the Give Jack Butler $1 million Act? That's my question. If that's all we do, if names can just sort of act as these magic spells for legislation. Use the word absurd, Rich. Yes, this whole thing is absurd. And I've found following it to be absurd because over the past couple of months, there's been this kind of ritual built up around some form of this bill. You know, Manu Raju asks Joe Manchin, like, have you changed your mind? Joe Manchin shouts at him from his houseboat or wherever he is, no. Meanwhile, Joe Manchin, for his part, delivers this kind of dispatch from like a rest stop on I-77 expressing to us how he feels this morning. And we just kind of go back and forth, and there's just been this attempt to kind of will this into existence as though, almost like the hippies who tried to levitate the Pentagon. But look, it's looking to me like they're going to succeed in levitating it, and it's just ridiculous because the bill, it's a misnomer. It's a grab bag of just wish list items. The only consolation, I guess, is that, and I'm always looking for consolation these days, I don't want to sound too pessimistic, is that this ultimately represents a reduced form of what we were afraid of happening last year. But the fact that that is the sort of lump we have to take here, it's just a testament to the perils of relying on two, centrist, but ultimately Democratic senators who will, at the end of the day, probably have different priorities, different priors at heart. And we're in this position because of strategic and candidate selection failures that go back many years. And this is just not ideal.
So MBD, they're not going to get anything politically out of this, except, and this isn't negligible, there are activists who have been so depressed at the lack of movement on this, are kind of this being fluffed up as some major accomplishment and something they can be really happy about, and Joe Biden finding some of his mojo again. And that's not something to completely sneer about is at least lifting your activist somewhat out of the slough of despond.
So I would go further than that. I mean, listen, $1 trillion bill is a big bill. Like, I don't think we should minimize it. It's a big bill. And it's a big screw up by McConnell. I actually think this is politically pretty beneficial for Democrats. I think it goes beyond just activists. I think this bill is a little bit of something for everyone. Both the electeds and the voters, right? So it's a fight inflation bill for Joe Manchin. It's a fight inflation bill and a climate bill for Kyrsten Sinema, which is what she would want. And it's a climate bill for anyone else who wants it. So, they can go to younger voters and say, we're doing something on the environment. They can go to older voters and say, we're doing something on drugs. They can go to drug companies, I guess, and say we're doing something on drugs. And then they can go to voters and say, like, we're passing legislation. We're getting things done. And I'm kind of mad at McConnell for letting Schumer get one by him this summer with this bill, because passing this and then seeing, you know, a couple of economic numbers improve, gas prices come down, Zawahiri blasted off the face of the earth. Yeah, like I actually do think Biden and Democrats have some momentum that they didn't have
in the Mojo caucus
2 months ago. No, I absolutely think that. I think it may be too late for them in November, maybe, but yeah, no, they're getting some traction. And you know, the environment could be much more favorable to Republicans. Like if you combine our two conversations, it'd be much better for Republicans if this bill hadn't passed, which was, I think, in the power of the Senate minority to prevent it from passing. And if, you know, Carrie Lake and a few of the others of these crazies hadn't won. So in effect, what I'm saying is I think Democrats have really helped themselves in the last 3 months.
Bill Klein, next question to you. Rate your level of disappointment in Joe Manchin high. You can't believe this man of principle betrayed us in this manner. Medium, you know, you appreciated what he was doing and thought maybe he'd killed the whole shebang. A little surprised that he turned around and pulled this out of a hat with Schumer or non-existent. You always knew Manchin was a big spending Democrat and was likely to go around along with something or other. High, medium, non-existent.
Yeah, I'd say it too. I'm always cynical, and I was saying all along that Manchin will cave at some point, but I thought I was proven wrong about that when he tanked the broader Build Back Better. But I never have much confidence that Democrats are really going to hold the line and kill their president's social spending agenda. So I would say I'm probably about a 2 based on how cynical I am.
So Jack Butler, high level disappointment, medium level non-existent.
I feel like these are settings for an oven. can I make one up? Medium high. It profits a man nothing, Joe Manchin, to
one of my favorite gain, settings. Medium high,
lose his soul and gain the whole world, but for a $1 trillion reconciliation bill. I mean, this is qualified somewhat by the fact that just having someone with a D after his name still doing some things that we like is nice, but that D does mean something. And Manchin is a sort of old fashioned style Democrat who is going to not be persuaded by arguments against just sort of classic pork larding politics to satisfy various interest groups. It could be, I guess, worse. It could always be worse, but it's not ideal.
Anybody?
Yeah, I guess I'm highly disappointed, but
you said you aren't.
I'm highly disappointed. I'm disappointed by Joe Manchin. I don't know if that matters to him. You're conservative.
He crushed.
But
hey, I drive.
But I'm still basically.
You should pick at his house with a sign. Highly disappointed.
But the thing is, like he could have. He could be a person who decided, hey, maybe I'll retire at the end of this term. And I'll just give my buddies the $5 trillion other dollars they want. And he didn't do that. So I'm disappointed in this, but I'm still so grateful for the other obstruction that it's hard to I don't know how it evens out in the end.
Yeah, I'm with Jack Butler once again. He nailed it. I was just gonna say I was between medium and high because I never had total faith in Manchin. I started very cynical, and then I just slowly believed more and more with the passing of every week. So medium high is also the right answer for me. With that, let's pause and hear from our final sponsor this episode, Act and Unwind. Inflation, spiking gas prices, and supply chain disruptions, woke celebs and corporations, political cronies, and big tech polarization and a culture in crisis. We know it's hard to stay up speed with everything that's happening in the world, and that's where Act and Unwind comes in. Join experts from the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty every Monday as they dissect the latest headlines in an easy-to-unravel roundtable conversation. Chat about politics, religion, and culture through Acton Institute's unique perspective. connecting good intentions with sound economics to promote a free and virtuous society characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. To subscribe to Acton Unwind, visit acton.org/NR. Just search Acton Unwind on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Again, that's acton.org/NR to subscribe. acton.org/NR. Please check it out. So, Jack, we have the aforementioned Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who I don't know, for 2 years now, it just seems whenever there's a controversy, he's finds a way to address it. Whenever there's a problem that conservatives are alarmed by, he finds a way to show he's seized of the matter. And this week, it was the removal of a woke prosecutor who said he wasn't going to enforce a number of Florida state laws that he opposed on political grounds. And DeSantis said, you know what, this is a law and order state. I have the authority, if you're derelict in your duty, to remove you, and bye-bye.
So what do I make of it?
Yeah, so really, I had to go all the way and ask that too, Jack. It wasn't implied.
Sorry, I should have interpreted your significant silence.
It's so habitual. I forgive me for leaving it out. So what do you make of it?
I make good things of it, I suppose. I can make a hat. No, sorry, Jim already used that joke. Darn it. Sorry, Jim. But yeah, so Ron DeSantis, often when he does things like this that are flashy, make a big splash in the media, you get this crowd of people on the left who freak out, call him the American Orban. He's clearly using his powers in a dictatorial manner. He's setting a template for future Republican autocratic rule, blah, 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 blah. These freakouts happen constantly. There was the one over him getting basically his own personal hit squad from last year was a great example of this genre. At the same time, there are a few examples where it could be argued that DeSantis is stretching his authority, but I do not consider this one of them. I think he is within the bounds of the Florida Constitution. I think this individual that's been removed was clearly just not becoming a classic case of the kind of person we have way too much of these days, who is in a role and just decides like, okay, I'm not going to do my job. I'm going to use this to increase my Twitter follower count or get myself an MSNBC news hit. So I think DeSantis did the right thing here. And I haven't really followed the reaction to this. I assume that the kind of headlines I was describing in caricature have already begun to proliferate from the usual suspects. And if that has indeed happened, then the usual suspects are in fact suspect on this matter.
So, Phil, yeah, the usual suspects are saying this is authoritarian, and it is a use of DeSantis's power, but it's a lawful power, and it is truly authoritarian if you are going to make up laws on your own, which is in effect what you're doing in the negative if you say you're going to ignore laws passed by Florida's Democratic bodies. And our colleague, invaluable colleague, Dan McLaughlin, wrote a piece about this the other day, and he cites Article 4, Section 7A of the Florida Constitution, which says the governor may suspend from office any county officer for malfeasance, misfeasance, neglect of duty, drunkenness, incompetence, permanent inability to perform his official duties, or commission of a felony, and may fill the office by appointment for the period of suspension. So it's right there in black and white.
Yeah, I think that there is a big issue, and we saw this on the broader scale, this issue of enforcement discretion, which we saw on a broader scale with President Obama and his efforts on immigration through DACA, where there's just sort of enforcement discretion. Now, there are some reasons why prosecutors have enforcement discretion, because there might be extenuating circumstances in which case it makes sense to go easier on a specific person for one reason or another. And there are good reasons to give some degree of discretion to those who are most familiar with the case and the sort of particulars. But what the trend that we've seen among Obama, but also increasingly from the Soros-funded DAs and prosecutors, has been where they explicitly don't like certain laws and they essentially try to make new laws or implement new policies through enforcement discretion. So there's a difference between saying somebody unconvicted, somebody who was involved in some sort of drug crime, that we shouldn't throw the book at him because of X, Y, and Z factors. It's a huge difference to say, well, there are all these drug laws on the books, but I think that drug laws are, I oppose drug laws, so I'm just not going to enforce or prosecute anyone for drug laws. The discretion isn't sweeping. It's not supposed to be where you change the law. And in this case, here we had a prosecutor who was explicitly vowing not to enforce various laws that were passed by the legislature. It's a clear dereliction of duty. It's refusing to carry out your sworn duty. So I think that based on the part of the Constitution that you just read, DeSantis is on strong ground here. And I think the political ramifications on this are clear. Obviously, it's not very hidden that after this running for re-election, if he wins this year, it probably pretty swiftly he's going to pivot into running for president. I think that's likely even if Trump runs at this point. And clearly he's making an effort to pick a lot of the issues that are really resonating with base conservatives right now. We've seen this in his fight against woke corporations, against CRT, against COVID restrictions, and we're seeing it right now with this fight against the Soros-funded prosecutors, which is a big issue. So I think it's both politically savvy, but also justified legally.
So MBD, the progressive left, they really have a problem with written law. You know, they consider a written constitution that we should abide by and just can't change on the fly. And it says there certain rights have to be protected. They have to be protected. They consider that undemocratic. And this is another case where their definition of authoritarianism is just bizarre and backwards. But let's just stick with the politics. We were talking about this a little bit before we started recording. You just think DeSantis is on fire.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like every month he does something that is a victory in itself or builds on a previous victory. And I think the timing is basically deliberate to constantly keep himself top of mind among conservative voters nationwide who began bonding with him over 2 years ago as he started taking the slings and arrows for reopening Florida. Intelligently, as he did, and I think he's been vindicated on that. And even a lot of conservatives who weren't ready to go along with him have gone along with him. And to me, this is a doubly brilliant move. So it's brilliant. First, these laws are popular. The laws that were mentioned that this county attorney didn't want to enforce are popular laws, right? They're a liberal, but somewhat restrictive abortion law, and forbidding the performance of these Orwellian gender affirmation surgeries on kids, where you geld boys and chop the healthy breast tissue off young girls, rendering them infertile or unable to nurse a child, etc. Respectively, so. Those are popular laws, so defending those laws is going to be popular with the political center. But removing the man blocking their implementation, that's a huge signal that conservatives want to see. because conservatives look at their political life and they see so many of their electoral political victories subjected to a kind of soft nullification, right? Mm-hmm. So, and the left has been using this a lot in the culture war ever since the Obama administration said, we're just not going to defend the Defense of Marriage Act. Mm-hmm. And I think for conservatives, it's a very particular anger that the bureaucracy or other office holders are allowed to just follow progressivism even against the law.
Yeah.
That's a particular thing. And I think it still even has appeal to the center because, listen, most Americans accept the duties of their station in life, right? Like most Americans are part of some institution. Maybe it's just where they're employed, where they have to follow rules that they wouldn't set if they were in charge themselves. So it's, you know, the very simple do your job or get out. I mean, that is the simplest political lesson to learn. And it's an important one for Republicans to actually vindicate. So I mean, we're saying that like DeSantis is just doing his constitutional duty. But for Republicans, that can be a very big deal. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it also signals to them, I mean, I wrote a piece on this, which I'm riffing on a little bit, but Trump's currency with conservatives was, hey, I'm going to demonstrate to you that I'll be different because I'm breaking all the taboos on what you can say. Mm-hmm. So I'm by disobeying the media's rules and game, playing the game my own way, I'm showing you that I can't be cowed. And I think that was very powerful for him, but he had a lack of stick-to-itiveness, a lack of follow-up that was extremely distressing to anyone who cared about governance. And what DeSantis is showing here is follow-up, and it's desperately needed.
So, extra question to you, Jack. Numbers once again rate where Ron DeSantis is on the scale from zero, the influence and power of a backbench Republican congressman, the way he was just several years ago, or 10, national dominance. Where is Ron DeSantis on that scale? 0 to 10.
Let's see. I'll put him at 6. That's where I feel like he's definitely raised his profile. He is, as Michael pretty convincingly argued, he's leading on most of the issues that the Republican base cares about. He's positioned himself well on them and is not really dwelling on what Michael in a separate article called Trump, or what, I can't remember the phrase, but basically Trump's grievances divorced from his actual policies. He's not dwelling on that because why would he? He's Ron DeSantis. So I put it at a 6.
Bill Klein.
I'd put it at about a 5. I think he's clearly growing in influence and has a lot of influence on the broader national conversation for someone who's a governor. But I think if you step back from the people who are political junkies and follow this stuff a lot, you'd probably find that most people don't know who Ron DeSantis is or only have a kind of a vague idea of who he is. So I don't think that, given that I gave Trump an 8, I don't think I could go higher than DeSantis being 5, although it's clear that right now he's the sort of prototype for what you'd expect the post-Trump Republican to be. And he probably has the best chance of anyone to unseat Trump in a 2024 matchup, assuming Trump runs.
So, MBD, we got a 5 on the table or 6 on the table?
It's an 8.
Where were you on Trump? 7? 6?
Yeah, it's an 8 because it's an 8, and it'll become clear to you guys over time.
Prophet.
No, I mean, talk to women in your life. They want DeSantis, not Trump.
Excuse me?
I'm dead serious. Talk to women in your life. They want DeSantis, not Trump. Women defected from the GOP in scary numbers in 2018 because Trump is a pig. Women are getting attracted back to the GOP because of Ron DeSantis, because he made it clear, like, I'm not going to force your kids to take the shot before they go back to school. I'm going to keep schools open. I'm going to keep gender weirdos and psychos out of the classroom. I haven't met a conservative woman who doesn't like this guy, and they're going to tell their husbands, and their husbands are going to, it's going to dawn on them that this is the future. And I think you're going to see numbers in his reelect among women and Hispanics that are going to make people's eyes pop and reconsider everything they thought about Donald Trump's chances in another race.
So we got
this guy is absolutely crushing it right now. It's like, if you can't see it, you're blind.
There's a line from the Aeneid, I'm being Boris Johnson here. I just happened to remember it in the original Latin. Dux femina facti, a woman, the leader of the deed. So this is what's going on here. I like it.
Wow. So yeah, we have a bold, all will be revealed in due time, 8 from MBD. I feel so timid. I'm with Jack. I've agreed with Jack on everything. I'm a 6. I can't put Trump at a 7 and have, you know, DeSantis equal. You know, maybe per Phil, maybe there should be some more separation there. But he's a huge figure now. He's raised money hand over fist. You know, look at the Real Clear national average, and Trump's beating him 20, 30 points. But there was one poll where DeSantis popped to within 9 of Trump nationally. There are a number of state polls now where he's basically even with Trump, and he's leading in Florida. You say, of course he's leading in Florida. He's the home state governor there. But I was looking back, and Trump hasn't been losing to a Republican in Florida, even Floridian Republicans, since July 2015, when Jeb Bush was narrowly ahead of Trump as Trump was rising. So, MBD, still got to think Trump's stronger. But DeSantis is definitely on the rise.
All DeSantis needs is a solid line about Fauci and maybe, like, you know, some risers in his shoes, and it's
to be clear, I'm sort of answering the question as right now in this moment as we're speaking. I don't disagree with MBD on the trajectory. I'm just saying in the current moment.
I wasn't
you're
told
you're moving people, MBD. You're moving the market, MBD.
I wasn't told we would be allowed to think fourth dimensionally. It's not fair. Okay, fine. I'll get myself unstuck in time if that's what it takes.
All right. So let's hit a few other things before we go. Phil Klein, you are now a nervous Yankee fan. It was impossible to imagine there would be such a thing the first 3 months of the season, but the Yankees have a 14 and 15 since July, made a truly mystifying trade right after the trade deadline, which seemed a good trade deadline for them, to that point where they trade a highly reliable lefty starter. At the same time, they have all sorts of question marks about their starting rotation. They're now embarking on a road trip. And you're nervous.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I mean, just sort of put my cards on the table. I've been a lifelong Yankees fan and Jets fan, so I've seen the highs and the lows. So whenever things get a little shaky, the Jets fan in me always comes out and I start panicking. And I have to say, you know, since the All-Star break, we're playing under 500. I am completely perplexed about the idea of trading Jordan Montgomery, a reliable, solid pitcher, for an injured outfield center fielder in Harrison Bader. But
yeah, with 256.
So for me, it just seems, I mean, look, we knew that they couldn't stay at the breakneck pace that they were in the first few months. But, you know, even Cole got shelled the other night, and the you know, if Nestor Cortez doesn't pitch like Sandy Koufax in the second half of the year, we have a lot of problems. And we still have problems beating Houston. We've been hurting against the tougher teams lately. There are only so many games against the Orioles.
The Orioles aren't patsies anymore. So yeah. MBD, speaking of problems, the Mets got one in the form of the Braves. They have a 5-game series here coming up this weekend, a bunch of other games with the Braves. Although it looked as though the Braves were going to had chased them down, we're going to overtake them. I think we're maybe at the Braves' high point, we're down a game and a half. Maybe it's back to 3 games. But anyway, you got some momentous baseball ahead of you as a Mets fan.
It's great to have like very meaningful baseball, even in August. It's exciting. The Mets recently, I think, on the day of the trade deadline, they activated the best pitcher in baseball, Jacob DeGrom, who looked amazing in his comeback start. So it's exciting that the team was deep enough to survive, an injury that took out their best player for most of the season. But now they're going to the stretch. It's exciting. It's exciting. And I'm finally getting my boys somewhat interested about this. And I don't know. Bring it on. Bring on September.
And Jack, you've been listening to Tame Impala?
That's right. So this happened, I started revisiting some Tame Impala stuff. Tame Impala is the solo project of the Australian multi-instrumentalist Kevin Parker. And this the occasion for me to revisit his work was, I was on a run. I'm not a real baseball guy. I'm a runner. I like having baseball. I like the idea of baseball. I like that people like baseball, but I'm a weirdo at NR and not really caring much about it. So cards on the table there. But I was on a run and a cyclist on a bike trail next to me had a speaker, which usually annoys me, but it just so happened to be the Tame Impala song, Let It Happen, which I know very well because I listen to it frequently. And it's a great song, 7+ minutes long, has a middle section that's intentionally made to sound like a CD skip, which I always wonder, like, if you played it on a CD player that began to skip at that time, like, would it ever stop? But anyway, I'm really into the Australian neo-psychedelic music scene, and no one's better at that than Tame Impala.
So I saw the movie Vengeance, written and directed by this guy. I hadn't paid much attention to him. Had no idea who he was. BJ Novak from the Office.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently, it's very skeptical at the beginning. It's kind of ridiculous, implausible setup with a lot of really unlikable, stereotypical characters. This New Yorker writer lives in the city and lives a typical existence of a bachelor of that class in New York City. Wants to be a podcaster. That's his big ambition. Goes down to Texas in unusual circumstances and meets these stereotypical, ends up living with these stereotypical Texans. But it really actually it is quite funny, becomes increasingly winsome and gripping over time, and is really effective and well done dark comedy. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, chip in.
My pick is Madeline Kearns's piece, which is titled No, Let's Not Get Sterilized, which it sounds like the weirdest come on ever, but she argues, she takes on some of the arguments being floated post Dobbs that the infertile life is the better life, and she makes a case that our given bodies and their capacity for reproduction is actually one of the great gifts given to humanity. Mm-hmm. And I'm totally with her on that one, although I'm with my wife on that one, but I mean intellectually with Maddie.
Klein, what's your pick?
I would pick Dan McLaughlin's piece, Vin Scully, A Personal Remembrance. This week we saw the passing of Vin Scully, the legendary sportscaster, and specifically baseball caster. And in the beautiful tribute, Dan reveals that it was actually his uncle, that his sister was... his mom was Vin Scully's sister, and so it's sort of a beautiful personal tribute that also goes through Vin Scully's remarkable career and influence as a sportscaster.
It is truly, truly beautiful. And I defy anyone to read the last paragraph of that piece without getting a little verklempt. It's very moving, and also has a really typical baseball crank worthy correction at the end. This article has been amended since publication to cite the correct World Series game in which the Giants were blown out by the Yankees. Jack Butler, what's your pick?
Well, so it seems only fitting that my first time on the editor's podcast, I would get an editor's pick stolen from me. And that was what Michael did by stealing Maddie's piece on No, Don't Get Sterilized away from me. It is a good piece. It should be read, but I will just demonstrate my sort of magnanimity by recommending that people read Michael's own piece, The Leader of the Opposition, which he riffed on in this episode here, but always go to the original. I was talking about music earlier. I'm more of a studio guy than a live guy. So just go to the original, go to the source, go read the original, and try to perhaps get accustomed to the far-seeing prescience of the time traveler, Michael Brennan Doherty.
So I was prepared to pick the Dan McLaughlin, Vin Scully remembrance, but I was ready to pivot in the likelihood that someone else is going to take that beautiful piece. And I'm going with another Dan McLaughlin piece that I mentioned earlier when we were talking about the firing of the Wilk prosecutor in Florida. His piece is called Ron DeSantis is Right on the Executive Duty to Enforce the Law. And if you want to know the legalities of this authoritatively and thoroughly, you must read this piece. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or count this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Jackie B. Thanks to NetChoice, Masterworks, and Acton Unwind. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.